Hello, this is Jory Slotkey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2018 issue of Discover Magazine. We will begin with the cover story, Alzheimer's Under Attack. Armed with big data, researchers turn to customize lifestyle changes to fight the disease. Sally Weinrich knew something was terribly wrong. On two separate occasions, she forgot to pick up her grandkids from school, and she kept mixing up their names. The 70-year-old retired nursing professor had to face reality. Her worsening symptoms, the forgetfulness and confusion, the difficulties communicating and organizing activities, weren't just stress or the normal wear and tear of aging. She lived in a matchless setting, on a lake in South Carolina, nestled in a bucolic wood. She swam daily and kayaked 3 days a week. But even her purposefully healthy lifestyle couldn't protect her from the darkness she feared most, Alzheimer's disease. In 2015, imaging tests revealed the presence of amyloid plaques, the sticky proteins associated with Alzheimer's disease that collect around brain cells and interfere with relaying messages. Weinrich also eventually learned she carried the APOE4 gene, which increases the odds of developing Alzheimer's. The disease was diagnosed after a neuropsychological evaluation. I felt a total sense of hopelessness, recalls Weinrich, who sank into a deep depression. I wanted to die. Shortly after, her husband heard a radio program about a new treatment regimen devised by physician Dale Bredesen that seemed to reverse early-stage Alzheimer's. The couple contacted the UCLA professor of neurology. Bredesen told him that, based on nearly 30 years of research, he believes Alzheimer's is triggered by a broad range of factors that upset the body's natural process of cell turnover and renewal. He didn't think it emerged from just a handful of rogue genes or plaques spreading across the brain. Bredesen has identified more than 36 mechanisms that amplify the biological processes that drive the disease. While these contributors by themselves aren't enough to tip the brain into a downward spiral, taken together they have a cumulative effect, resulting in the destruction of neurons and crucial signaling connections between brain cells. Normally, synapse-forming and synapse-destroying activities are in dynamic equilibriums, explains Bredesen, but these factors can disturb this delicate balance. These bad actors include chronic stress, a lack of exercise and restorative sleep, toxins from molds, and fat-laden fast foods. Even too much sugar or being pre-diabetic heightens risk. If you look at these studies, you see the signature of insulin resistance in virtually everyone with Alzheimer's, he says. If you look at all the risk factors, so many of them are associated with the way we live. In spring 2016, Weinrich underwent an extensive evaluation that included blood and genetic tests, online cognitive assessments, and a year later, an MRI to spot the underlying mechanisms contributing to her cognitive troubles. The imaging scans show that her hippocampus, the brain region that regulates memory, had severely atrophied and was in the 14th percentile for her age. 86% of peers were better off. Bredesen says other tests he administered revealed high concentrations of fungus and mold toxins in her system, which he interpreted as residual damage from exposure to mold that had festered in the basement of one of her previous residences. Also discovered were deficiencies in other areas that might contribute to dementia, such as high levels of fasting insulin. Bredesen crushed all these results with a computer algorithm that calculated a complex 36-point personalized therapeutic program to counteract Weinrich's specific constellation of deficits. Initially, she was overwhelmed, but she gradually incorporated the changes into her lifestyle. She now sleeps about 8 hours a night, fasts 14 hours a day starting in the evening, and begins her morning with a 30-minute meditation. She takes a host of supplements, has cut down on carbs, and increased her vegetable consumption, and gets plenty of exercise that includes yoga, Pilates, swimming, kayaking, and hiking trips. I felt better almost immediately, says Weinrich, who once again engages in meaningful conversations and plays with her grandkids without embarrassing cognitive lapses. I have my life back. Weinrich's apparent improvement begs the question, could one of our most dreaded diseases really be eased by strict adherence to almost monastically healthy habits? This new approach is based on the premise that our modern lifestyles, along with environmental assaults from infectious pathogens and toxins, are as much to blame for Alzheimer's as renegade genes or plaques. Growing evidence suggests we may finally be on the right track. Until now, the quest for effective Alzheimer's treatments has been marked by costly high-profile failures. A stunning 99% of drugs tested have flopped. Nearly all the drug candidates have targeted one of the key hallmarks of Alzheimer's, amyloid plaques, the barnacle-like proteins long considered the main culprits behind the disease. When scientists made the link between amyloid and Alzheimer's in the 1980s, drug makers jumped in on the bandwagon in the hopes of inventing a trillion-dollar drug for a progressive and fatal disease that affects more than 5 million Americans. But a growing cadre of physician scientists at major research institutions, like the University of Alabama and Weill Cornell Medical Center, believe we've placed too much emphasis on these sticky proteins and have ignored other equally important miscreants. "We are barking up the wrong tree," says David Geldmacher, founder and program director of the Alzheimer's Risk Assessment and Intervention Clinic at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. A number of observational studies, which track people over time, have yielded insights into many of the culprits linked to Alzheimer's. The laundry list includes chronic stress, lack of exercise and restorative sleep, insulin resistance and diabetes, low kidney function, high blood pressure, inflammation from exposure to infections and environmental toxins, poor nutrition, small strokes, heart disease, concussions, genetics, and a lack of social connection and mental stimulation. Taken together, these factors account for up to half of the risks for the disease, according to a 2011 review in Lancet Neurology. When people have a specific combination of these drivers, which interact differently from one person to the next, the signs and symptoms of the disease emerge. Because there seem to be multiple pathways to developing Alzheimer's, there may also be multiple ways to slow or even thwart the progress of the illness, says James Galvin, a neurologist and founding director of the Comprehensive Center for Brain Health at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. "This is where big data can come in," Galvin says. "You can look at patterns, and when you have a cluster of patterns, you can tailor therapies based on an individual's profile. Outside of age and family history, these are risk factors that we could actually do something about and design interventions on a personalized basis. Address brain health using lifestyle modification and medication and treat any underlying diseases like diabetes or heart disease." And that's what we're doing, using a precision medicine-like approach that looks at each individual's risk factors and creating a treatment plan to slow or prevent the onset of Alzheimer's disease. This relatively fresh perspective on Alzheimer's, both in terms of its causes and in the use of computer algorithms to devise individualized therapeutic plans, represents a dramatic shift in the way we approach the disease. Scientists like Leroy Hood, a biotech pioneer who was at the forefront of technologies behind the Human Genome Project and Big Data Analytics, thinks this is at the leading edge of 21st century medicine. It hinges on using large data sets to personalize treatments and ferret out therapies that target a patient's unique genetic makeup. "Alzheimer's is really a complex disease that has been utterly intractable," says Hood, co-founder of the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle and chief science officer for Providence St. Joseph Health, one of the nation's largest nonprofit healthcare systems. "Taking a systems approach," he says, "reflects my own conviction that these complex diseases almost never respond to a single drug." In the meantime, though, thorny questions remain. While increasing numbers of physicians think lifestyle changes can slow or even stop the descent into Alzheimer's, in the absence of definitive clinical trials involving hundreds of people, the gold standard to prove efficacy, some scientists are deeply skeptical. "A variety of factors are linked to Alzheimer's, but association doesn't prove causation," says Victor Henderson, the director of Stanford University's Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. "Alzheimer's is very complex, and one simplistic approach isn't likely to be the magic bullet. If there were simple answers, people would have come up with them already." Treating Alzheimer's has been a challenge because, until now, little meaningful progress has been made. Neurologists on the front lines have felt powerless, watching their patients disappear into the sinkhole of forgetfulness. Big Pharma's focus on a one-size-fits-all anti-amyloid drug and the billions in funding that went with it largely eclipsed a dramatically different story that was quietly emerging from independent academic studies over the past decade. Other health conditions, such as our sedentary lifestyles, poor eating habits, type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, and skyrocketing obesity, play a huge role. "But you can't package or patent a lifestyle," Galvin dryly observes. In his darkest moments, Galvin wonders if he was doing anything for anybody. He had so few weapons in his treatment arsenal, only a handful of marginally beneficial drugs approved decades ago that can temporarily enhance thinking and functioning. Studies that linked Alzheimer's to a range of modifiable lifestyle factors prompted him to make subtle changes in his practice. He began to more aggressively treat the health conditions that contribute to the disease. He would prescribe medication to lower his patients' blood pressure, statins to control cholesterol, or suggest exercise regimens or dietary changes to lessen insulin resistance and improve brain health. I started to see that my patients seemed to progress much slower than my colleagues, and the patients would tell me the same things, Galvin recalls. He discovered some of his fellow neurologists were taking a similar tack. The same light bulb is going off. At the University of Alabama at Birmingham, Geldmacher gives each patient a detailed and personalized risk assessment that encompasses family history, performance on tests of mental acuity, and results of MRI scans. By controlling their risks, people can maintain their well-being through physical exercise, mental stimulation, and a healthy diet, says Geldmacher. Those three things may help lower their risk for the disease or slow it down. That's where the field is going. Richard Isaacson, the founder and director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center, spends hours with each patient doing a thorough health analysis. He uses cognitive tests, body measurements, and brain health computer assessments, as well as lab tests and imaging exams, MRI or PET scans, to pinpoint areas that can increase the odds of developing Alzheimer's. We look at genetics, we look at cholesterol, we look at glucose metabolism, we look at body fat, says Isaacson, who was inspired to do this work after watching four family members succumb to the disease. Then we triangulate this information, using each data point with the context of one another. Based on their risk factors, patients are prescribed a regimen of exercise, methods to reduce stress and get more restorative sleep, prescription and over-the-counter medications, and even nutritional supplements to compensate for their deficits. In people who dutifully follow the program, Isaacson says early research indicates that cognitive function does improve in critical areas such as executive functioning and processing speed, or how fast information can be absorbed. Intuitively, we thought this would work, said Isaacson. Now we actually have proof. While the evidence remains largely preliminary, these individual cases have reached a critical mass, which indicates something is happening that needs to be explored in a more rigorous way. In September, nearly a dozen physicians from Puerto Rico, Kansas City, Alabama, and New York met in Chicago to share what they've learned, what seems to work and what doesn't, and begin the arduous process of figuring out how best to test a treatment platform that can be used everywhere. We're trying to lay the groundwork for Alzheimer's prevention and figure out what tools we should be using and what works best, says Isaacson. But the field is still in its infancy, and so we literally learn every day. In the meantime, Bredzin, the UCLA neurology professor, has been touring around the country, promoting his program through his best-selling book, The End of Alzheimer's, and giving lectures at scientific conferences and talks to community groups. Still, his controversial approach is more than its share of detractors. You don't want vulnerable people spending money on something that isn't yet proven to work or be safe, says Keith Fargo, director of scientific programs for the Alzheimer's Association. But many people who follow this program seem to benefit. While their stories are anecdotal and the details differ, there are some common threads, with several talking about reclaiming pieces of themselves they thought had vanished forever. They have requested anonymity because of the stigma of Alzheimer's disease. One middle-aged nonprofit director living near Chicago noticed that she was becoming forgetful and was horrified to learn that she carried two copies of the APOE4 gene variant, meaning she has an especially high chance of developing Alzheimer's. Now 56, her symptoms have subsided after a stringent program of diet, exercise, and an array of supplements. A lawyer on the East Coast was only 40 when she could sense she was being pulled into the quicksand of Alzheimer's. Her father was already gripped by the disease, and it had claimed her grandmother, too. Within a decade, her thinking became muddled, and she was at a loss for words and language. She had forgotten Chinese and Russian. After 6 months following Bredzin's protocol, the fog lifted, and within 2 years, she could speak foreign languages proficiently again. The story of one successful entrepreneur is especially significant because his decline was well documented. He had gotten PET scans and neuropsychological tests every few years, starting in 2003. The imaging tests revealed patterns of early-stage Alzheimer's, and subsequently he learned he carried the gene variant. As the years went by, friends and colleagues noticed his deterioration. By 2013, tests indicated his decline had accelerated, and his neuropsychologist suggested he shutter his business. It was very sobering, he says. I thought about selling my business while there was still something to sell. The businessman met with Bredzin, who used the data culled from his evaluations and crunch the information in a software algorithm to devise a personal plan that the entrepreneur dutifully followed. 2 years later, another battery of neuropsychological tests revealed his scores had improved. His verbal learning and memory and auditory memory had jumped from substandard to superior. His neuropsychologist had never seen anyone make this kind of recovery in his 30-year career. You can't fake these, the entrepreneur says now. It's not like you can drink a cup of coffee and do really well. These approaches offer hope to the millions at risk for Alzheimer's and their families. In the near future, these physicians believe Alzheimer's could become a chronic but manageable disease, much like diabetes or heart disease. Like these life-threatening ills, if Alzheimer's is left unchecked, it can be severely debilitating and deadly. But proper treatment and lifestyle changes may be able to stave off symptoms for years, enabling people to live more satisfying, productive lives. Alzheimer's is a life course disease, meaning that cognitive health starts in the womb and is influenced by what we do throughout our lives, says Isaacson. By treating the underlying conditions, we can have a positive effect on brain health, reduce risk, and even prevent the disease. Burn notice. 30 years after flames ripped through Yellowstone, scientists study the sites to understand future fires. In 1988, ecologist Monica Turner found herself on the shores of Yellowstone Lake as the forest burned. She happened to be in the national park to collaborate with fellow ecologist Bill Rome to study historical fires with computer modeling. When the enormous new conflagration took off, coughing smoke into the air, into their eyes and lungs, and creating its own weather patterns, the researchers knew it would be significant. That fall, they returned to the park, and Turner got her first aerial view of the aftermath. She could see that the fire's damage had not been contagious, but rather a mosaic of burned and unburned areas. Turner has never looked away. A total of just over 1,240 square miles would burn that year, more than a third of the park. And although news reports at the time marked Yellowstone as destroyed, that hasn't been the case. In the 30 years since, Turner, now at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has amassed a considerable amount of data and scores of papers. What she and her colleagues have found was surprising at first. Many of the burned areas renewed from within through serotonous cones, which require heat to melt their resin coatings and release their seeds. Perennial grasses and wildflowers sprouted the first year after the fires and flowered profusely the second year. Aspen trees, which typically regenerate from asexual root suckering, began to regrow as seedlings, something the researchers had never seen in that area before. Rome, who is now retired from Colorado State University, and colleagues have reconstructed over 10,000 years of Yellowstone fire history and found that this monstrous fire was actually the kind that happens every 100 to 300 years as part of a natural cycle. The 1988 fires were not an ecological catastrophe, and I think the main thing that we learned from all of that research is just how resilient Yellowstone's forests were, Turner says. Yet as the planet warms, drought, high temperatures, prolonged heat, and other conditions are lengthening the burning season and making severe fires more common, not only in the park but also around the world. How forests will cope is not clear. Turner thinks the research produced after the Yellowstone fires of 1988 can serve as a benchmark for how forests might respond to repeated burning and the hot and furious fire, the future that may await them. Climate change has been expanding the fire season. A 2016 paper by researchers from the University of Idaho and Columbia University found that rising temperatures have led to an additional 16,216 square miles of forest burning in the United States between 1984 and 2015, forests that wouldn't have burned otherwise. The same researchers found climate change led to 9 more days of high fire potential each year from 2000 to 2015. These fires can burn forests that have been standing for some time or reburn forests recently incinerated. Turner is concerned about the more frequent fires that consume areas previously charred, called repeated short-interval fires. While the 1988 fires burned old-growth trees, many between 100 and 250 years old, the ecosystem was adapted to such fires. Repeated short-interval fires, on the other hand, are destroying younger trees, some less than 20 years old. Different trees produce cones and seeds at different ages, so very young trees may burn before they can produce viable seeds. Some pine trees produce serotonous cones annually, but not until they start producing seeds. The lodgepole pine, for instance, begins producing viable seeds at 5 to 10 years old. These cones stay on the tree from year to year, increasing the tree's seed supply until a fire erupts. areas reburned before the trees have had a chance to build up their seed supply may have a more difficult time recovering. Turner and her team are studying a handful of these reburned areas to understand how the increased frequency of fires may affect ecosystems. On a hot, sunny day in late July, a group of Turner's researchers gave me a tour of three of these sites. One burned in an unnamed fire that occurred around 1872, another site burned in the 1988 Huck Fire, and a third burned in the 2000 Glade Fire. All three were reburned in the 2016 Berry Fire. Soon after we rendezvoused south of Yellowstone National Park, we were walking through a sea of blackened lodgepole pines. The standing charred trees, called snags, tower over a forest floor carpeted with lupine, fireweed, wild strawberries, pine grass, sedges, and other plants. Charred fallen trees litter the ground. Postdoctoral researcher Nathan Gill points out a seed trap, one of nearly 600 he had set up this summer to study how effectively windblown lodgepole pine cone seeds travel into burned areas. He's placed the traps, greenhouse flats with a hammock of landscape fabric and mesh to keep rodents out, in areas with varying densities of snags and vegetation. Some he placed among tightly spaced dead trees, and others in areas with only a few scattered branches. He'll check the traps in the fall, counting seeds to see if the snags interfere with seed dispersal. The team members hypothesize that they will find fewer seeds in the reburned areas than older forests, and fewer of them the farther away they sample from the unburned edge. If they're correct, it could show reburned areas have a harder time at regenerating and recovering from the frequent fires wrought by climate change. Tyler Hoker, a PhD student on the team, is studying how once dispersed lodgepole pine and Douglas fir seeds, grow in these recently burned areas, which are typically sunnier and hotter than unburned areas. Hoker has seed trays about 20 inches by 10 inches that contain either 50 planted seeds of Douglas fir or 50 seeds of lodgepole pine, as well as control trays with zero seeds. In late spring, he set up 12 study plots with the trays equally dispersed among locations on south-facing slopes, presumably warmer and drier, north-facing slopes expected to be cooler and wetter, and flat sites predicted to be in between. The team hypothesizes fewer seeds will survive on south-facing slopes and at lower elevations since those locations are generally hotter and drier. Every 2 weeks, Hoker hikes to each site, recording which seeds germinate, how many survive, and how well they grow. At these sites, Hoker has embedded sensors in the ground to collect data on soil temperature and moisture, while meteorological stations at each site collect data on air temperature, humidity, and solar radiation. Camera traps keep an eye out for curious critters that may interfere with the results. It's been surprising just how warm it can get right below the soil surface, Hoker says, noting soil temperature is often much hotter than the air temperature and can reach over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The results of this study could help scientists understand the mechanisms and then anticipate how different trees will respond to different conditions. Eventually, the seed dispersal and growth data, along with other data points, will be plugged into an individual-based forest process model developed by one of Turner's colleagues, Austrian ecologist Rupert Seidel. The model, called ILAND, is designed to address the changing dynamic of forests and can be modeled for use in different forest types. The Yellowstone data is used to examine how species such as lodgepole pine and Douglas fir will fare and regenerate under different scenarios, including ranges of climate, fire frequency, and distance from seed sources. An important aspect about this model is that it's basically building from the ground up, Turner explains, noting that the model is based on tree physiology and relies on daily data about solar radiation, precipitation, and temperature. When we're looking out into the century, where the conditions are really different than anything we've seen in our historical record, we can't assume that relationships that are represented maybe 40 years ago are going to hold in the future, Turner says. While Turner and her collaborators are working to develop new tools to examine fire, she reflects on the fundamental changes at hand. I think that the rules of the game are changing now in the sense that the recovery that we see in the future may not be the same as we've seen in the past, Turner says. Our systems are often more resilient than we think, but I also think we might be pushing them to breaking points. And now we have time to read an excerpt from 20 Things You Didn't Know About Penguins. Number 1. Penguins loom large in pop culture, but they were once even bigger. Several extinct giant penguins, such as human-sized Kumamanu Bake described in 2017 could have tipped the scales at more than 200 pounds. Number two. Today, their sizes range from the blue penguin, just over a foot tall, to the emperor penguin, nearly three times as big. Regardless of size, all penguins have the same body plan, including wings that have evolved into flippers and dense bones to counter buoyancy. 3. Hard evidence of the very first penguins is lacking. However, based on a 2014 genetic study, the lineage may have split off from their closest relatives. A group of seabirds that today includes albatrosses and petrels, around 60 million years ago. 4. The limited fossil evidence, though, suggests a deeper past. Consider the oldest known penguin, Waimamu Manarangini, which lived about 61 million years ago in New Zealand. Number five. In 2017, paleontologists found another penguin nearby that was about as old. This animal was different enough from the Waimamu Manarangini to suggest that the birds were already a diverse bunch. That hints at an earlier emergence, perhaps more than 66 million years ago when T-Rex was still stomping around. Number six, the roots of the word penguin are also debated, but according to most dictionaries, it derives from pen-guin, the Welsh term for white head. Seven, the word originally described great auks, a large black-and-white flightless aquatic bird that once called the Northern Hemisphere home. 8. In the 16th century, the Golden Hind was exploring the South America's Strait of Magellan when a Welsh sailor aboard noticed a black-and-white aquatic bird. Thinking it resembled an auk, he called it a penguin. 9. Great auks went extinct in the mid-19th century, but their Welsh name lives on, forever associated with a completely unrelated bird. Now that's awkward. 10. Auks were limited to the North Atlantic, while penguins are Southern Hemisphere-only animals, almost. The territory of the endangered Galapagos penguin straddles the equator. 11. You might think of Antarctica as penguin central, but it's the exclusive home of only two species, the emperor and the adelie. Most species don't even hang out on ice. 12. The African penguin, as its name suggests, can be found on Southern African coastlines. The Humboldt penguin, meanwhile, likes to build nests on high ground along rocky beaches of Chile and Peru. 13. On New Zealand's South Island, the yellow-eyed penguin, also known as the hoiho, prefers forested or grassy locations. The least social of penguins, they space their nests well apart and hidden from each other. 14. The South Island's mountainous, dramatic southwestern coast is home to breeding colonies of the Fiordland penguin, though the penguins don't maintain their residence year-round. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you'd enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slotke, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138.